Senior Focus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is an edition of Senior Focus dedicated to women's health. And I'm delighted because it's the first time I've done a program that's solely focused on this. And I have with me as a guest today Sue Claridge, who is a health researcher and writer of some 24 years' experience. She's been in a number of... So welcome, Sue.
Thanks, Anne-Marie.
And it's a huge topic. We can't do justice to everything about women's health in half an hour. But we're going to start off by having a conversation around the fear that people have at the moment often of what it might entail if they go to hospital, because there's so much publicity about the overcrowding in hospitals and the nurses being on shifts where they haven't got enough staff to actually do their work properly. So with that in mind, it does make people rather apprehensive of what they might strike in the health system if they need it. So that's our starting point today. And I know that Sue, in her writing and research, is right over what's happening in the system. So would you like to give us a breakdown?
Right, well, I think there are issues. There's no doubt there are issues in our health system. There's understaffing, there's delays, there's long waits if you have to go to the emergency department. But I think it's important to put that into perspective. One of the most important issues for patients, for health consumers, is to stay as healthy as possible and try and avoid the need to go to the emergency department. Of course, there are always going to be exceptions to that. People suffer injuries. They might have, sudden acute conditions for which they must go to hospital. But by keeping an eye on their health and doing what they can to maintain their health, they reduce the chances that they will need to go to hospital, particularly in an emergency situation where the emergency department might be understaffed or have huge numbers of people to deal with. Of course, if we're talking about the emergency department, weekends are often the worst times. So that's a time that people should avoid if they can possibly do so. Part of the reason people go to emergency departments is because they either put off going to a doctor until they're so unwell that they're so sick that they need to go to an emergency department, or because they can't afford it. So again, maintaining your health, putting time and effort into maintaining your health and reducing the chances that you need to go to hospital is really, really important. You also need to remember that the people who are working in hospital, they are there because they're dedicated to helping people. They don't go into a health profession, into a health career, either as a doctor or as a nurse, unless that's, they're passionate about improving people's health. They're trying to do the best they can in the circumstances in which they have to work and with the resources that they have. So what people will find when they are in hospital is, while health professionals might be really overworked and have far too many people to deal with than they should, they will be doing their absolute best for every patient that's there.
Hmm. Indeed, and I have seen that firsthand myself. Some people might wonder why we're focusing on women's health, and I just wanted to say and reassure you that in the future we will have a program on men's health, and we have had one in the past, and we are looking for a male broadcaster to actually look at these issues with our audience. So never fear, we are trying to be balanced here. Now, that wasn't meant to be a rhyming pun, but it's kind of like, at the moment, sometimes people are not really fully aware of the vast differences between women's health and men's health. And heart issues are a problem, heart attacks. I mean, it's taken a long time for women to get assessed and diagnosed and treated well, and it's still not happening entirely. And most women are more likely to die from a heart attack than from any other condition, even more than breast cancer. So it is important, and I noted myself when I became a patient at North Shore Hospital that 40 of the cardiologists out of 40 were male, and yet women's heart issues are quite specifically different in a lot of respects. And so that the lack of having a gender balance in the actual staffing is quite important. So those are the things that I've come across. And so I'm wondering how you'd like to comment on where we're heading with this.
Well, it goes back a lot further than just what you experienced in a hospital. So your experience in North Shore Hospital and finding that all the cardiologists are men. But the issue with the disparity between men's health and women's health, and things like the fact that women, it's only just recently become widely recognised that women experience heart attacks. The symptoms that they experience in a heart attack are quite different from men. So the things we've been taught for years about how, you know, what it feels like to have a heart attack is quite different for women than it is for men. And even when a heart attack is picked up, women don't get the same treatment, the same evidence-based treatment, and as you pointed out, they're more likely to die from a heart attack. But this is an issue that goes back to medical research. For decades, if not centuries, women were often excluded from medical research because we're complicated. We have different hormone systems, we have different immune systems, we're complicated. And so there was this assumption that women were just a slightly different version of men. You know, we were just like men, but with breasts and a reproductive system that, you know, carried the baby to term. Women are very, very different. It might astonish listeners to find, to learn that up until very recently, there had been no research on how general anaesthetics work in women. It was just assumed that we had the same dose-dependent response to general anaesthetic as men did, but we don't. We respond completely differently, and it's only very recently that research has been done on how women respond to general anaesthetics compared to men. So the inequities that we have in healthcare arise out of the inequities in health and medical research.
Yes, it's so well put. Thank you. I think it's really important for us to consider what it means to have a health system that actually caters for the population we have. And while we can't talk about population health today, what we do need to look at in terms of inequities is the social determinants of health. And that's quite a mouthful, and well known in the health professional circles, but not so much known by the public. So in terms of inequalities and the social determinants of health, how would you unpack the main ideas that we refer to when we think about prevention?
So the social determinants of health have a significant impact on achieving good health and well-being and preventing ill health. So when we talk about the social determinants, we talk about things like housing, income, education, occupation, things like domestic violence, justice, and of course all the disparities, social disparities and inequities exacerbate the social determinants. So if you're Maori or Pacifica, if you're a woman, or if you're from the LGBTQI community, all the inequities are going to be exacerbated if you also fall into those demographics as well. So we can't fully address health or poor health prevention, preventing poor health and conditions, such as cardiovascular disease and diabetes and cancer and so on, until we address some of these social determinants of health. There is also the commercial determinants of health, and those are predominantly the use of or overuse of alcohol, overindulgence in alcohol, use of tobacco products and vaping, and poor diet or unhealthy food, ultra-processed foods and fast food. So all of these factors have a role to play in both an individual's health and health across the population.
And we're going to have a program delving more into this at the beginning of next year. So if you stay tuned with us during January, you'll find mid-January we're going to have a program that looks into this a lot more. Going back to the health system as a whole, it can be difficult to see what needs to change in the system. And at the moment, with the nurses and their campaign about their lack of safety on the wards because they've got insufficient numbers of nurses in roles actually doing the work, their campaign has been, I think, very well handled and broadcast. So it's not news to people. But I'm just wondering how we can fix this broken system, the system that's not able to meet the need, that has people in the corridors and so on. And looking at, as it's got worse over many years, and we had the same sort of issues in a winter of 2018, it was particularly bad. I'm just wondering, you know, from the policy point of view, what sort of interventions are likely to work the best?
Well, a lot of people within the health system, and I'm not just talking about the nurses and the doctors and so on, but people quite high up within the health system and within policy development. And people, so one of the people, for example, is Sir Ashley Bloomfield. And he, like many others, have advocated for a very long-term plan. So it's a minimum of a 10-year plan, so that health is no longer a political football that and policy is developed based on the electoral cycle. What we need is a long-term plan that all of our main political parties sign up to, so that we can look at improvements that take longer than 3 years. And much of what needs to change in the health system and what needs to be done to improve the health system and make health accessible and affordable and available and appropriate and acceptable, and when I say appropriate and acceptable, I mean culturally appropriate and acceptable for all New Zealanders, no matter where they live, is to have a system that's invested in and over a long period of time. So we need this long-term, minimum 10-year plan that everybody signs up to and everybody says, right, this is the plan, this is what we're going to do, and it's going to work.
Yeah, this is very important because within this decade coming, we've got a rising senior population, people over 65, and a more vulnerable group over 80 with high rates of dementia. So we're looking at about 780,000 cases of dementia, most of whom would be managed or would need care and probably an aged care bed and support workers. So thinking about that issue and the need to have access to GPs and so on for an ageing population, GPs that have a background in gerontology and understand the ageing issues, we definitely need some planning because we haven't got things in place now that even cater for this group now. So we're going to be in a difficult situation a few years down the track.
Absolutely, and it needs a multi-pronged approach. The reality is that it is much cheaper, both as an individual and as for the country as a whole, to achieve and maintain good health than it is to try and claw back good health from poor health as people age. So dealing with poor health in an ageing population is extremely expensive. And it's much better, both economically and in terms of quality of life, for people to enter their older years in a state of good health and to work hard at maintaining that health, because it's just so much harder to get back health once you've lost it. So for individuals, they need to be looking at what they can do as soon as possible. We can't, when you talk about dementia, once that's developed, all you can do is slow down the progression. It's not something you can reverse. And many age-related diseases and conditions, you can't cure them. You can only slow progression. So we need to look at the things that we can do individually, as well as expecting our policymakers and our Ministry of Health and our health entities to do their bit to maintain people's health. And again, prevention is key.
And there is, of course, sometimes a lot lost in translation when people are in silos. I mean, they're being treated for their heart, but their problems may be stemming from digestion. So they haven't got angina, really. What they've got is a reflux problem, GERD. We get these kinds of things where the system's focusing on one problem, but meanwhile there's another problem over here that's being ignored.
Well, there's two problems there. First of all, the medical system is reductionist. The way that we approach health from a medical point of view is to reduce human beings to organ systems. And we get this with specialists. They're only interested in one type of system. You know, there'll be gastroenterologists and there'll be nephrologists who deal with the kidneys. And there'll be, you know, gynecologists who deal with women's reproductive tracts and so on. We need to start seeing human beings as whole beings and look at, as you mentioned, the impacts of indigestion and what that really means and where does that come from? Is that stress or is it poor diet? Are people getting enough exercise? And part of the problem with that is it's very hard for GPs, who are the first, that primary health, they're the first port of call for most people when they become unwell. It's very hard for GPs to look at the whole patient when they've only got 15 minutes. And likewise, even in our hospitals, our health professionals are understaffed, overworked. They don't have time to look at the whole human being and ask the right questions. Are you getting enough sleep? Do you have sleep apnea? Are you getting enough exercise? What's your diet like? What is your relationship like? What are your social connections like? Are you stressed? Do you have... are you concerned about your finances? All the sorts of things that impact on people, particularly as they age.
And I can, in hearing you outline all these factors, a holistic approach makes sense because the body isn't these separate organs operating in silos. The body is very much a holistic system. So it's looking at the impact across the board and how these things all fit together. And just recently they have introduced health coaches into the primary care practices. So when you go to see your GP, there is a possibility you can be seen by a health coach to look at making changes in your diet or in your exercise or in dealing with issues. Like they have also health advocates who will go with you to the Ministry of Social Development, to WINS, or will connect you with groups in the community that have actually got other people exercising and making changes in their health, and you can join a group that's focused on doing the very things that you're going to have to do.
Absolutely. Having health coaches and there's also green prescriptions where a doctor, rather than prescribing more medicines, will prescribe a better diet, more exercise, getting out in the outdoors, exposure to the sun, things like exposure to early morning light to improve your sleep, to improve your serotonin and your melatonin and so on. The other thing is that what we really need is a truly patient-centered health system and interdisciplinary health system, where particularly for people with complex health needs and multiple conditions, which is more common as people age, just to develop more than one condition. So it might be diabetes and cardiovascular disease and arthritis and so on, is to have a health team with interdisciplinary skills so that they can look at the whole person, and rather than just focusing on one condition or one part of the body.
And I know that you yourself have been patient-centred and you've advocated for advocates over the years, and you've got a very strong passion around this. And so thank you for these comments, because that vision of what the system could look like and what it could deliver and how much better it could be for everyone, I think is a vision to hang on to, and it's something really important that we should not lose sight of. I guess it's also linked, though, to what funding is available and what direction the government wants to take. And that goes back to having a plan that incorporates a vision that's actually in keeping with the research, what the research tells us about what's the best way to fund health and what you can get out of your efforts.
More and more people are advocating for a patient-centred health system. Some of my work with the Health Consumer Advocacy Alliance is focused on a completely different approach to our health system and the way that it interacts with health consumers, with patients, looking more at a partnership between health professionals and patients or health consumers. I'd love to go into that, both ideas, in a bit more detail. We probably don't have time today, but there are ways of changing the health system and the health system approach so that it is more patient-centred, that it's more interdisciplinary.
And we will do...
Whole human beings.
And we will do a program especially to focus on this next year. That will be probably program number two in the middle of February, because I can see that there's a whole education process of lifting awareness of what we can do and how we can do it and what people are doing in some more enlightened parts of the world.
Absolutely. We can look beyond just what we're doing here in New Zealand and look at what has been really successful in other places.
We don't have to reinvent the wheel, but we also don't have to repeat ourselves and go down the road of doing what we've always done, because we know we'll get what we've always got, which is a quality outcome.
Absolutely.
So, Sue, in terms of your advocacy and your passion for patient-centred health and also ensuring people get their rights or have their rights respected, have you got examples where you've been able to work effectively on these issues?
I think it's important that if people feel that they may have their rights ignored in a health setting, whether it's with a GP or at a hospital, is they have the right to take a support person with them. That can be really important in terms of being able to remember things that they were told, having the support person prompt them for asking questions. And also, it's much more difficult for someone to deny a patient's rights if there's someone else there who can back them up. So I think a support person is really important. If you're not happy with the service you've got, you have the right to complain. But also, if you don't think that you're being taken seriously or you're not happy with the response of the health professional, you can seek a second opinion. And I wouldn't hesitate to recommend people to seek a second opinion, particularly with a very serious health condition or where they're being suggested to have, recommended a treatment that is quite significant, drugs or perhaps surgery that they think they may not need. You also need to know your own body really well. You need to be able to go to a health professional and say, this is what's normal for me and what the symptoms I'm experiencing are not normal, and insist that they be investigated.
Mm. That's very sound advice. I can testify that's something I tell myself sometimes, and I've had good outcomes doing it. And sometimes it's hard for people because they don't like to speak up. They don't like to feel that they're being a nuisance, and particularly if staff are harried and overworked and there aren't enough of them, it's difficult to speak up. But a support person gives you that extra cushioning, that extra kind of courage, if you like, to actually get answers and seek answers. So, yeah, thank you very much for that. And it's been really a challenging program because there's so much to cover, and there's so many rich things that we can tap into. So we're looking forward to doing a series next year, and it will be very rewarding for people to know that that's coming up, and you'll be able to set time aside to tune in, or you can always get our podcasts online by going onto the Planet website, www.planetaudio.org.nz. And so before I end the program, I do want to point out that you are the communications advisor for Auckland Women's Health Council, and you have been the co-founder of the Health Consumers Advocacy Alliance. It was something I didn't make clear at the beginning. So these roles have enabled you to develop expertise and experience over this 20-year plus period. So we've been very pleased to have you on board and have you contributing. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk to your listeners.
And I wish you well in what you are up to. And I also know that there is a very good newsletter comes out a few times a year, which is going in depth on some of the sorts of topics we've talked about. Would you like to give the listeners your email address so that they can shoot an email off if they want to receive a newsletter or they want specific questions answered?
Sure. We produce a newsletter 4 to 6 times a year. It's freely available. There's no subscription fee. People just have to sign up and say they would like it delivered into their email inbox. Feel free to email me. It's Sue, and the email address is awhc@womenshealthcouncil.org.nz, and the Women's Health Council is all one word, no spaces, no dots, all lowercase. Or you can find us online, our website, womenshealthcouncil.org.nz, and there is a form there to sign up for the newsletter if you'd like to do it that way.
Well, that's brilliant. Thank you for your time and energy today, Sue, and we look forward to having more programs with you, and thanks to the audience for listening.
Thank you very much.
Right. Get together with Senior Focus next Sunday at 5:25 p.m. on Planet FM 104.6, or listen online at any time at planetaudio.org.nz/seniorfocus.